That's the worst Christmas.
Hello, and welcome to the second part of my chat with Nigel Roberts. Just for a little bit of clarity and context, part one ended with Nigel discussing the Waterstones campaign, and we were just about to go into a conversation about what it was like working through the mergers that had Nigel and Paul end up at TBWA.
Yeah, and as you touched on before, you sort of remained there while it merged until you ended up at TBWA. And what was it like being there in, I guess, quite a large agency with Trevor Beattie in charge?
Again, it was another fantastic place to be, because BST merged with GGT Goldgreen Lestrade. And so we were there, I think, for less than a year before it then merged with TBWA that had already merged with Simons Palmer. So effectively, there were four agencies that all had really good reputations for differing campaigns and different styles of work, but collectively, all together, under one roof, was amazing. Their client list was just unbelievable. And Trevor Beattie was... I think it was still in the days when there was only one creative director. So Trevor was creative director, and it was great because we'd worked on continued to work on the Baines Fair Sharky Trot campaigns. By that time, we'd done the Waterstones campaign, and we'd done the Tate Gallery, and we'd done Kew Gardens. He kind of left us to look after those accounts, and so it was great. It was almost like we had our own little sort of creative agencies worth of accounts to ourselves in the corner, and it was great. It was just a really healthy agency that was producing great work on lots of accounts, as well as the stuff that various people were doing on PlayStation was brilliant. It was a really, really buzzy, great place to be, really, and a big department and a lot of good people there as well. And there's a lot of energy to the place. It felt good.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned going back to look at all the great copywriters of DNAD. I just wanted to bring up, because there's no one else who can bring this up. Well, I can bring it up with Paul as well, I guess, as when I speak to him. But the 2001 DNAD annual seems to be so ridiculously crammed with your work. I don't know if there's, what, like five pencils and a bunch of nominations. But I remember in one afternoon at AMV, I must have been slightly bored, but even so, I think I counted like 50 or 60 entries there. I mean, what was it like having quite that level of, I don't know, DNAD acceptance for lots of different campaigns as well?
It was great. It was massively satisfying. Obviously, the great thing was that it was for different clients, completely separate campaigns on them. So we went into it thinking that surely some of them must convert and everything. We'd got enough chances to collect something from the nominations, and unfortunately some of them did, but it was great. It felt as if we were properly established in the work from that, really. And so you try and avoid being arrogant or cocky about it and everything, because obviously there's always a degree of luck in getting your work produced. There's lots of great people in great agencies producing great concepts that just never see the light of day. So fortunately for us, because I think because of the structure of the agency and whatever, we were able to get those all that work on all those different accounts produced, which was brilliant. So to have that much work to enter was great, because I know that you can so easily go 12 months, a couple of years without having a single piece of work that your hand on heart feel is worth entering for things, and then you start to worry. So yeah, it was a very, very satisfying time, but unfortunately I've not had a chance to repeat that sort of volume of work that I'm as proud of since then.
So. Well, yeah, I don't think anyone has. But one of the best campaigns of that time, I think, was The Big Issue. Just to single out one of the headlines, I think, "How can you heroin sort your life, heroin out when the heroin only thing heroin you heroin can think of heroin." I love that because it's a totally new headline construction. I mean, obviously the whole point of it and the idea is somewhat unique, but it's not like you've just taken that sort of wry double look at something. I thought that was a really great headline and a really great campaign. So how did that come about?
Well, we knew when we got the brief to work on it that it was an opportunity to do something interesting, but we kind of, as you say, it wasn't a sort of fairly standard headline construction and everything else, because it felt like it would be wrong for a subject like The Big Issue to try and be clever. It's not sort of, that would be pointless. It's an amazing service and everything else. So it was, you don't want to be selfish about it and just do ads for awards. We wanted to do a campaign that would get under people's radar and people would want to read. And I think we were well aware at the time that there are so many different charity campaigns around, and most people see either the sort of harrowing black and white photography or the big logo in the corner or the coupon or whatever else it is that suggests that it's a charity ad, and use that as their instant sort of screening mechanism for not giving it any attention. And so we wanted to do a campaign that would be very, very different as we could make it, really, to other campaigns. Hence the whole look of them. At the end of the day, there isn't any sort of harsh, harrowing photography, and there's no logo on it. Paul suggested to them that it wouldn't actually do them any favours, quite the reverse. It would probably get more attention if people didn't see that it was from the instantly see that it was from The Big Issue, and amazingly they agreed to that. We did a lot of research. I remember buying lots and lots of books about the misery of drug addiction and homelessness and everything else, and that was thoroughly depressing, but at least sort of gave me some insight into the dreadful situation that people selling The Big Issue are in. I think it was always really, as a campaign, I think the main thing that we needed to do was just to try and get people to understand that people in that situation aren't necessarily just taking, if you like a supposedly easy way out, that horrible things have happened to those people and they're there through no fault of their own, and to get people to just think about the individual before dismissing them and think what might have gone wrong in their lives for them to be in that situation. So each of the ads is basic. I think each one of them sort of covered a different backstory that is true for a lot of people in that situation. So whether it's drug addiction or child abuse or whatever. And it was a chance for me to write some longer copy than usual. And it was exactly the sort of campaign that we both liked doing. And it was great that it worked out.
Yeah, and I remember just a few days ago I was in the car with my son, and he saw a homeless person and said, how come they end up homeless? Why would they do that when it's such a horrible situation to be in? And I remembered your headline. I remember, if cold, wet, hungry and scared is what thousands of kids run away to, imagine what they run away from. And it really puts in perspective, and you go, this terrible situation they're in is better than the other terrible situation they were in. And the cold logic of that is really quite crushing, I think. And from there, you went to Ogilvy then?
Yes. Steve Dunn was, I think by that time they'd introduced the title of Executive Creative Director. So Steve was Executive Creative Director at Ogilvy. And we went over there to be Creative Directors. And the amazing thing was, we sort of thought, well, Ogilvy's a big sort of, it was a fairly lumbering beast at that time. It had done fantastic work in the past, but it was a little bit, it was looking a little bit tired. So we thought it was a step up for us to be creative directors. And that was the appeal of it, but also the appeal of some huge pieces of business with money to spend on producing big campaigns. But we thought that we'd have to go there and sort out the creative department. We just assumed by the work that was coming out of the agency that the creative department was lacking in some ways, and we'd have to probably let some people go and get in some new people. But as soon as we got there, we realised how wrong we were, because it was full of brilliant creatives. They just weren't getting the chances, or the work wasn't being supported. And so it was a different challenge to the one that we sort of went in there expecting. We just sort of thought, well, if the work the creative department is producing is up to scratch, then the clients will buy that and everything will be good. But it wasn't. It was more a case of it was that learning curve of how much you have to nurture and protect good work through the process, really. If you do that, it wasn't a case of getting different creatives to come up with, or making the creatives that were there work harder. They were the work that they were producing straight away, we saw was just fantastic.
Yeah, so, one of the good ads that you did at that time was the Gillian Waring kind of thing for paedophiles online grooming children. How did that happen with her?
Well, we had the brief. It was, as you say, it was the COI warning parents to the COI, if anybody doesn't know, it's sort of government body, sort of public information, if you like, and it was to warn parents of the dangers of paedophiles grooming children on the internet. And it was before anybody'd invented Wi-Fi, so computers were plugged into the wall, and largely it was letting parents know what was going on with grooming, and suggesting that they make sure that the computer's in the living room or whatever else, and children aren't sort of exposed to all this garbage. And so it was a print campaign, and they wanted TV as well. And so we were thinking about the TV for quite a while, and then we had a concept, we had an idea, and absolutely hand on heart, it was totally inspired by Gillian Waring's Turner Prize winning piece. It was a video piece with children, with adults talking, but with the voice of very young children. And it was such a weird thing to see. It's been done many times now since then, but at the time it was very original and it was very powerful. And we thought that conceptually that was perfect for this message that we were trying to put out, that adults were pretending to be children online in order to start to build relationships with children and this, that, and the other, and eventually whatever. So it was around the time, I think not long before then, there'd been a fuss about a certain ad. I won't name which one or anything else, but there was an ad which there was a big fuss about whether or not the concept was original, and it had been inspired by another piece of work by an artist or whatever else. And so there was the big debate about whether the creators behind it deserved the credit they were getting. And we thought, well, there's no point falling foul of that or pretending otherwise. We were happy to admit that Gillian Waring's piece was absolutely the inspiration for it, but it fitted. There was no reason to just ignore it just because it was an art piece. It worked perfectly to achieve what we wanted this TV spot to achieve. So we thought, well, rather than we could get in touch with her and ask her if she was okay with doing it, but she'd made the video for the Turner Art Prize piece anyway, so why not get her to help us make it and direct it, which she agreed to do, and it was great. So it had she gave it the same sort of integrity that her original piece had done, and it meant that everybody was absolutely clear that no one was trying to steal anyone else's thunder or ideas or anything else. It was just absolutely, if there's something that is clearly a strong trigger for something or whatever else, why bother pretending that it wasn't? So.
Yeah, absolutely. So as someone who'd been a big fan of obviously David Abbott, Richard Foster and people like that, it must have been pretty exciting to get the opportunity to go to AMV then.
Yeah, it was. It was just a real shame that that David had already left AMV at that time, because Once I decided that actually this copywriting business was good and I liked it and it's what I wanted to do, then the two agencies that, as a copywriter, I always wanted to work at would be Legas Delaney and Abbott Mead Vickers. And I'd done Legas and worked, had the pleasure and honour of working to Tim. And I'd love to have met David and learned from him, but unfortunately he'd gone. But still, the agency was full of so many people who were creative directors of other agencies, and so many great people. Richard Foster was still there, and there were so many really, really amazing people there. It was great. It was still a fantastic agency. So Peter gave us the opportunity to work there, and we jumped at it, and it was great.
And were you particularly looking forward to working on, say, The Economist?
Of course. It was arguably the best poster campaign in the world. It's fantastic. I mean, for a publication like that that has a fairly limited audience, whether you are in the market for buying The Economist, whether you gave a monkeys about it or not, everyone still appreciated the ads because they were just clever. They were rightly clever to sell a magazine about being clever and making yourself rich and as a consequence to it. So they were great. My own, we were talking before about the sort of the headlines and everything that made you think and sort of presented an insight that touched your nerve. For me, the best headline, Economist headline ever was, "Would you want to sit next to you for dinner?" I can remember, I think I was sitting on a bus going past that at the time and just thinking, that was brilliant. It's just so good. I mean, so many people, surely, it must have made some people buy The Economist if they hadn't done before. Oh, there had been many great executions beforehand, but for me, that was the one that's always been that was a new benchmark for me.
Yeah, I think it's interesting also because the thought is brilliant, but also the execution of it. Like, you could write that thought in a million different ways about, you know, are you boring at dinner, do you, whatever. But I think the way David wrote it really made you think twice and just
was
just fantastic.
Yeah, rather than make it a statement that you might choose to disagree with or whatever and take insults to it and whatever, making it a question and then very nicely presented question and everything else, it's just sort of disarmed it a little bit, but still, it's a very powerful thought. It was great.
You guys CD'd the Economist as an account. So was it interesting working on it and CD'ing it at the same time?
Yeah, well, a few of the agencies I'd been at before, it was great to have campaigns where there were ongoing campaigns and everybody knew the rules. And so everybody got to work on them at Saatchi's. There was Silk Cut and Castlemaine 4X and whatever else. To an extent, TBWA, there was PlayStation. The posters certainly were. I think they were quite an open brief at TBWA. So it's great to have those sort of campaigns. So the opportunity to creative direct The Economist, just, you didn't really have to do much. You were just a filter for the work that people come out. Everybody in the department worked on it. And I think we produced six or eight executions every 6 months or so. And so when it came close to presenting some new concepts to the clients, the word would get out that it was Economist time again. And so, I mean, you were there, you'll remember.
Yeah.
It was, as soon as it was ready to review work, we just having this enormous pile of fantastic concepts to go through, and all you had to do was pick out your favourite. I think we picked out the dozen or so that we thought were the strongest and put them on the wall a couple of weeks before it was time to present to clients, and they were there as the sort of benchmark. That was what was to be beaten if anybody got any more or better ideas. And so by the time it was presentation time, you're in no doubt at all that you had more than enough great concepts that the client, as long as the client bought some of them, it was going to be another good batch of Economist ads. It was fantastic. How long did it go on for? Was it 25, 26 years or something?
Must have been. I think it was like, you know, maybe the 89 book had the first one, maybe. So, yeah, it must have been 20, 25 years.
But, I remember, I think Paul and myself did a spread for campaign, I think it was, celebrating the 25th anniversary, but I'm not sure how many years it went on for after that, to be honest.
No, I think there was some desire to sort of change things up. I was also wondering, and I'll probably get into this with Dave, but I remember him coming across an interesting situation where someone else in the agency asked him to have the odd one that was a pun, because obviously there are different kinds of economist ads. Did you feel like you needed to get a sort of a span of different ones to make the campaign, or was it just whatever was best?
I think whatever was best. I wasn't a huge fan of the visual pun ones. They always sort of struck me as being a little bit, there was this god-awful TV show called Catchphrase.
Oh, yeah. And
it always reminded me of that, and I just thought that was a little bit, it was lowering the bar a little bit for a publication as intelligent as The Economist. It felt like you weren't going to sort of, it wasn't there to expand the audience quite to that extent, so they didn't feel like they were sort of living up to the promise that the best executions sort of presented in the past, really. It just felt like it cheapened it a little bit. So I think the desire was obviously to try and compete with some of the work that people had produced in the past, but I think the real challenge was to try and do it in slightly different ways, just try and open it up a little bit. And there were some really good ones. The one with the jigsaw piece, and there was no logo in the corner, and there were various twists on it. But as long as it wasn't just a visual pun, I think it was anything was kind of fair game, really.
Yeah, and I guess another client with a really great heritage of fantastic advertising, going back to David's time, was the RSPCA. So, how was it to work on that?
That was good. We worked on so many charities beforehand and everything else, and so you kind of, again, I think the main thing was, as with the big issue and many others, to just try and do it in a non-typical charity way, really. But the clients are different and they have different expectations, and sometimes clients just think that a charity ad should look like a charity ad, and that's it. But I remember there was Christian and Andy did a campaign for the warning about fireworks, loud fireworks upsetting pets and everything else, and that was a great little campaign. It looked brilliant, and you at a glance you'd never have imagined that it was for the RSPCA, which hopefully meant that it sort of more people paid attention to it than would have done otherwise. And the I don't think there were that many briefs that we actually got to work on during our time, but there was the Battery Hens one, that campaign was good to work on. We did that, and that was, I think, again, Paul did a fantastic job of it. I think the photography and the typography and everything was stunning. So my part of it was quite straightforward, really, to just try and present people with as inarguable a case for thinking twice about buying better eggs from Battery Hens as possible, and then Paul made it impossible to ignore. So I think that's what we always try to do, really. If Paul made it engaging, and I tried to make it persuasive. So.
Yeah, now, you brought over a few of the best creatives from Ogilvy at that time, who turned out to be just really fantastic and very successful themselves. Yeah. Were you trying to put, like, I don't know if you just, these guys are good, let's bring them in, or you kind of thought there's a bit of a gap in the agency for this kind of creative or that kind of creative. Was there much method to it?
Not really, no. I think there certainly wasn't. I don't think Abbott Mead Vickers was exactly lacking in creative talent by any means.
Not really.
I think it was more a case of there were just people that we'd met for the first time and really loved working with, and really appreciated how good they were. And we, if they were in other agencies where they didn't perhaps have the opportunity that they deserved, or they were still at Ogilvy or wherever they were, we just kind of wanted to work with them again. So it was funny looking back at it. I don't remember whenever there was anybody that we sort of thought we'd like to hire. don't remember having to go and ask somebody whether we could have the money to hire them. Maybe we did. Maybe I've just forgotten that. But it feels, as far as I can remember, we just sort of we offered them a job, and then they started on Monday, and somebody in finance sort of worked out paying them a salary. It was great.
Yeah, I think someone once told me that Peter, I may get the figures wrong, but someone just told me Peter had like a budget of 3 million quid for the department and then was just able to spend it on whatever he wants. So like his, whatever it is, $500,000 on Tom and Walt, his 60 grand on a junior team, his whatever. But no one ever told him, you know, how to do it or whether there was too much or too little happening, which, you know.
Yeah, I don't remember anybody ever sort of saying, well, okay, you're allowed to hire another junior team or anything else. I think it was a case the agency was still flying, and anyone that was sort of that you thought could actually add to the capabilities of the agency was, yeah, just get them in and get on with it. So I don't think anybody had any problems with it. Obviously it's all very different everywhere these days, but
yeah.
Happy days.
Those were days. And so from there you moved to CHI and you know, did some great work on the Prince's Trust. And how did that differ to AMV?
Very different agency, because I think the industry was changing, really. And obviously, yeah, CHI, at the time, I think when we joined, they were about 8 years old or something. And Johnny Hornby was the managing director of TBWA when we were there. And clearly, he was going to achieve great things. And I can remember noticing every time they won a new piece of business, which was fairly constant. So it was the agency was growing and growing and growing, and things had changed at AMV and everything. And so we went there, and it was still an agency that, yeah, it had a lot of energy, and it was still building and growing. And Charles Inge was who's now sort of handed over the reins of the creative department, but he was still there and very, very great. I was author of one of my all-time favourite TV ads, Litany for the Independent.
Yeah.
Everybody, Simon Clemmow, fantastic planner from part of great stuff at Simon's Palmer and everything. And Johnny was the consummate account man. So a great combination of people in an agency. And so it was just a very different place. And so we went there. And I think the Prince's Trust was one of the first things we worked on. But it was obvious that the industry was changing. The time that you had to work on things was less and less. The internet was beginning to have an increasing influence, and people were talking more about the wider scope of requirements on campaigns into all kinds of different media and everything else. So it felt like the way that Paul and myself had traditionally worked was, it was less of an opportunity to work that way, really. It's you had to produce a lot more concepts to get anything bought. There was more focus groups were engaged more and more on things. And as I say, this is in all agencies seem to be going this way. And so you never knew how long it was going to take until you'd have a concept bought, if ever. And when they finally did, then suddenly you were expected to turn it around in 24 hours if it was a print ad or something, or kick, bollock, scramble with getting a director, whoever was available, and could shoot it as quickly as possible and get out the door. And yeah, it was a shame. It just clearly things were changing, really, and there wasn't that time to sort of consider things. And yeah, you had to produce a hell of a lot more concepts before you got to produce an ad. And it's sort of continued that way ever since.
Yeah. It is a bit of a shame how things have gone. I guess people who are newer in the industry have got new opportunities because there's different media and stuff like that. But it feels like the degree.
Yeah, I don't want to sound like a complete lala and just. No, I wang on about it. It was better in the old days, but it was certainly simpler. That's all. I think instincts and intuition were trusted more, and there was a lot less involvement on scrutiny from focus groups, and everything required less validation from the masses. which, as I said, just made it simpler, and it was easier, and it also allowed more time to then produce the work and inject the craft skills that everyone should want to sort of put into it, really.
And after that, you sort of came slightly full circle by returning to Legas. Was that an easy decision or a tough decision?
No, it wasn't. I'd been at CHI for about 4 years, and then Tim and Margaret, who I knew from DMB&B days, they got in touch and asked if I'd be interested in looking after the London office, because the network of offices was sort of expanding, Milan and I think it was all in Paris and Hamburg and various places anyway. So Tim and Margaret were more and more involved with the group, and so they wondered if I fancied looking after the London office as its creative director. And and at first I thought possibly not, and I wasn't sure, and it took me quite a while to realise that actually it was such an amazing agency, and Tim's still there, and whatever Tim's ways of working and everything else, I've always thought you'd struggle to find anyone, certainly a creative in the industry, that's got more integrity than he has, because he's always passionately wanted to do the right thing for the client. It's not about winning awards or anything else. He wants to do the most effective piece of work that he possibly can for whichever client he's representing at the time, and which is great. There aren't any conflicting agendas. It isn't about chasing awards or just chasing the money. And I thought, well, given that he's, even if he is still involved in the group, it's his agency, it's independent, and there aren't going to be those pressures from other places. And so, yeah, why not? It could be great. So I accepted and I went back.
Cool. Well, we're coming up to the, well, we've actually gone over the hour a bit and sort of come towards the present day. I don't know if there was anything else you wanted to say about, you know, advertising or the way things are or anything like that.
Especially, as I say, I think it has changed. Whether it will change again, it's interesting that there's a lot of talk now about possibly some of the mistakes that might have been made in the last few years. I think there's a lot of agencies have sort of lost their way a little bit, and I hope that they'll find their way back. I think next year will be really interesting. I think there will be a lot of change. Things like Karma Rama being bought by Accenture, yeah, has opened a whole different can of worms. The Spark 44s, they're working for their setup with Jaguar Land Rover. There seems to be different ways of doing things now, and whether the traditional model of an ad agency has to think again about what it's going to do in order to sort of continue to thrive, or in some cases survive, that'd be interesting. I think the main thing is it'd be great. The work could be better, I think, and I hope it does get better. I think if people can work out why or how to get the respect back for agencies, really, and the work that they do, I think a lot of work isn't as effective as it used to be, whatever media it's in. I think it's, we were talking before, the last time we spoke, about the agencies I always loved were the ones that I felt did the most effective, persuasive advertising that engaged and gave you a good, they helped you understand which brand to buy and everything else. And I think the industry needs to start doing a bit more of that, and hopefully it will soon. So
yeah.
So it's still a great industry, and I still love being part of it as long as it'll continue to have me. So.
Absolutely. Well, thanks very much. I'll do my very best not to spill water on this particular interview. I think for the sake of my IT department as much as anyone else. But huge thanks again for making a second hour to speak to me. And
thank you.
I'll put it up. I may not put it up in the middle of Christmas, because it won't get lost, but people will end up going back to it. So I might do it at the start of next year.
I think everybody's got better things to do over Christmas.
Oh, you'd be surprised. I think any way of escaping would be good for other people. But anyway, yeah, thanks a lot, Nigel. And yeah.
No, my pleasure. Thanks, Ben.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye.
This is a podcast that was Christmas.